Last time we demonstrated that a vast diversity of what we would call norms of biblical sexual ethics are presented in the scriptures. Some of them we would agree with today, and some of them we would disagree with, and others we would find positively repugnant. We noted that fidelity, mutual respect, and genuine love were the ultimate goal in relationships, and that promiscuity, infidelity, abuse, control, and defilement were the focus of biblical criticism in sexual relationships. At other times, we observed that poor translations or cultural norms have caused us to read things into the Bible that were either not there or have proven to be misguided in light of modern science and psychology. But that still leaves us with a very few, unambiguous statements in the Bible that do indeed condemn homosexual practices. So today we're going to look at those and look at the question of biblical authority. Before I begin, let me just address the potential criticism that I'm just, quote-unquote, doing away with Scripture, something I have been accused of many times in the past, that I'm just doing away with Scripture in order to validate what I want to validate. In other words, to make the Bible say what I want it to say rather than what it actually says. And my answer to that is that reading the Bible with fresh insight, rather than a prefixed theology and doctrinal framework, isn't doing away with anything. The attempt is to actually rediscover the truth of Scripture, and it is scraping off some of the rust and the corrosion and the bias and even the bigotry that has accumulated on our belief system over the past 2,000 years. When Darwin wrote his famous Origins of the Species by Means of Natural Selection, he wasn't trying to do away with God or creation. He was attempting to explain how life on Earth had developed over time from simple to complex organisms, yet it still caused the fundamentalist Christian world to shake with fear. However, even though Darwin's research wasn't attempting to challenge the Christian faith, his work contradicted in places the Genesis account and was thus branded as heresy and is still considered demonic, satanic lies even by many Christians today. Nevertheless, as in Darwin's time, logical, consistent principles must be applied to our understanding of scriptures and theology. So let's get back to the topic of biblical sexual ethics. As we saw last time, we regard today certain rules, especially in the Old Testament, as no longer binding on the church today. These include rules that have no statement in the Bible saying that they are not still binding today. We just consider them no longer binding. And there are other things that we regard as binding, including legislation from the Old Testament that is not mentioned at all in the New. So how do we decide which rules to follow and which rules to reject? For example, virtually all modern readers would agree with the Bible in rejecting incest, rape, adultery, and bestiality. But we disagree with the Bible on many other sexual mores. The Bible condemned the following behaviors, which we generally allow in the church: intercourse during menstruation, celibacy, interracial marriage, nudity under certain conditions, and birth control, although there is still a large segment of Christians who still forbid this. And the Bible regarded semen and menstrual blood as religiously unclean, which we do not. Likewise, at various times, the Bible permitted behaviors that we would today in the church condemn, such as prostitution, polygamy, levirate marriages, that is marrying your brother's wife if you died, sex with slaves, with or without their consent. Their consent wasn't required. Concubinage, treatment of wives and daughters as property, and very early marriages in what we would call generally biblical years. The average age for a girl to get married was between 11 and 13, likely including Mary, the mother of Jesus. We would call that something else today, and we would never allow it in the church. But there's nothing in the scriptures that says we've reconsidered this and decided that's too early for a girl to get married. It is our culture that has determined that. So why do we appeal to these proof texts and scriptures in the case of homosexuality and bring it out of that context and say, no, we can't make any adjustments to how we view homosexuality, when we feel perfectly free to disagree with scriptures regarding many other sexual practices? Obviously then, if we're honest, many of our choices in these matters are arbitrary and changing over time. Mormon polygamy, for example, was outlawed here in Canada and the United States, despite the promise of religion of freedom, to do as you will with your religion, because it violated the sensibilities of the dominant Christian culture, even though there is no explicit biblical prohibition against polygamy. The Apostle Paul reminds us that if we insist on placing ourselves under any part of the law, then we're obliged to keep all of the law, down to the last detail. We see that in Galatians 5, verse 3. But if Christ is the end of the law, as Paul also says in Galatians 10, 4, if we have been discharged from the law to serve the Spirit, not under the old written code, but in the new life, in Romans 7, verse 6, then all of the Old Testament sexual mores comes under the authority not of the law, but of the Spirit. So we cannot then take even what Paul says about homosexuality and create a new law out of it. The crux of the matter, it seems to me, is simply that the Bible has no single, unified, consistent sexual ethic. Instead, it exhibits a variety of sexual mores, some of which changed over the thousand-year span of biblical history and writing. Mores are simply the customs accepted by a given community. And we know even in our own lifetime, some of what culture would accept has changed greatly. The Bible only knows a consistent love ethic, which is consistently being brought to bear on whatever sexual mores are dominant in any given country, culture, or time. No sex act in and of itself is ethical, outside or without reference to the rest of the person's life, to the pattern of the culture and special circumstances faced. So rules and norms within the church tend to be more about domination, and they generally serve as a form of crowd control and behavior control rather than attempting to encourage fullness of life, which Jesus said he had come to bring, and fullness of human potential. So what I'm saying is we must examine any sexual more at any given time by the culture and ethic of love established and exemplified by Jesus. So such a love ethic is, first of all, non-exploitative. That's why we are against the exploitation of children, for example. Using other people is against the love ethic. Secondly, it does not dominate. Now, fortunately for us, there's no such thing as domination within a heterosexual marriage. So they're okay, right? Wrong. Any domination of one person over another is wrong. And I can add that any time you read in the scriptures about submission to one another, submission is not for anyone else to ever impose upon you. This is not the military. Submission is a personal choice to act in a way that is cooperative with and submitted to someone else. If someone doesn't wish to submit, there's nothing in scripture that suggests someone else must insist on that with fear and threats of punishment for not doing so. And clearly, it is stated in the scriptures that we submit ourselves one to another, all of us, not women submitted to men in particular. So it doesn't dominate. Hence, there should be no patriarchal treatment of women as chattel, which we see in the scriptures, which we see in the old and even sometimes current culture. That we don't accept and don't agree with. Thirdly, love is responsible, mutual, caring, and loving. So our moral task then is to apply Jesus' love ethic to whatever sexual mores are prevalent in the given culture. And that doesn't mean that anything and everything goes then. It means that everything is to be critiqued by the commandment to love one another and to do no harm to others. We can challenge both gays and straights to question their behaviors in light of love and the requirements of fidelity, honesty, responsibility, and genuine concern for the best interests of the other and society as a whole. As a disciple of Jesus, if that's what you consider yourself to be, can you really believe that an abusive, controlling, manipulative, and loveless heterosexual marriage between a man and a woman that has somehow managed to stay cobbled together for 30, 40, or 50 years, celebrating their golden jubilee with all their families and friends, praising that they hung out and stuck it out together for that long in a loveless, disrespectful, controlling, abusive, manipulative relationship. As a disciple of Jesus, of what you know about love and grace, can you really say, honestly, that that is better than a caring, mutually respectful, life-enhancing, love-filled homosexual partnership? Think about that. Christian morality, after all, is not an iron chastity belt for repressing urges, but a way of expressing the integrity of our relationship with God. It is an attempt to discover a manner of living that is consistent with who God created us to be. Homosexual orientation is no more a matter of morality than left-handedness. It simply is the way some people's sexuality is configured. Let me repeat that. Homosexuality and homosexual orientation is no more a matter of morality than left-handedness. If love is the highest virtue, then as Christians, we need to move beyond the acrimony and the brutality that has so often characterized the Christian behavior towards gays, that in no way reflected the example or the teaching of Jesus. Approached from the point of view of love rather than law, the question is not what is permitted, but rather what does it mean to love all my neighbors? Approach from the point of view of faith rather than that of works. The question ceases to be what constitutes a breach of divine law in the sexual realm and becomes instead what constitutes obedience to God's love revealed in Jesus Christ. An approach from the point of view of the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law, the question ceases to be, what does the Scripture command? And becomes, what is the word that the Spirit speaks to the churches now in light of Scripture, tradition, psychology, theology, genetics, anthropology, and biology? We can't continue to build biblical ethics on the basis of bad science. In a little remembered statement, Jesus said in Luke 12:57, "Why do you not judge for yourself what is right?" You don't hear that talked about too much in churches. Why do you not judge for yourself what is right? Why can you, followers of Jesus, not apply the principles he left, the new commandment to love one another, that love does no harm to others, that love is faithful and sincere? Why, he says, can you not apply that to make your own decisions? Why do you look to scriptures for the laws and the rules about what, who can and who cannot attend your church services? Such sovereignty and freedom strikes terror into the heart of many Christians, especially fundamentalists, and they would rather be told what the law says and told what to do and how to live their life, and especially how other people live their life, so that you get to tell them what they can and can't do. Paul himself echoes Jesus' sentiment immediately preceding one of his possible references to homosexuality, when he says in 1 Corinthians 6:3, "Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more should we judge matters pertaining to this life in this culture based upon what we know today of psychology, anthropology, biology, psychology, genetics?" In Paul's time, they didn't know. They didn't even know that the female egg contained DNA and contributed to who that child was. They thought it all came from the male. So, of course, the scriptures reflect some of that lack of knowledge. The last thing that I believe Paul would want is for people to respond to his ethical advice as a new law engraved on stone. That's not what he was trying to do. Paul was telling people, you should know better. You should know how to make decisions. He criticized the Corinthians for the way they took the Lord's Supper and made it into some kind of a feast where they were just gorging themselves and getting drunk. And he doesn't quote some other scripture saying, it says somewhere that you shouldn't do that. He says, you know not to do that. You know better than that. He says at other times, why are you behaving in this manner? And he says, you know better than that. Paul is himself trying to judge what is right. And sometimes he is right, and sometimes he is wrong. It isn't up to the church to tell a woman how long her hair should be. At that time, in that culture, men did tell women what was appropriate. We don't agree with that. And remember, Paul, when he wrote these letters to the churches in Corinth and Ephesus, etc., he wasn't writing scripture. He was writing pastoral letters, personal letters to people that he knew in churches that he had started, giving them advice, not laws. We have made Paul's advice into new laws after he said, we are not bound by laws, but in the Spirit. So if we in the church in 2019 have new evidence available on the phenomena of homosexuality, and we do, are we, the church in 2019, not obliged? Are we not free to reevaluate the whole issue in light of all the available data and decide for ourselves? Is this not the radical freedom for obedience which the gospel itself establishes? Where the Bible mentions homosexual behavior at all, and it's very rare, it clearly condemns it. I freely grant that. The issue is precisely whether the biblical judgment is correct. The Bible sanctions slavery as well, and nowhere attacks it as unjust. Nowhere. Are we prepared to argue that slavery today is biblically justified? 150 years ago, when the debate over slavery in the American South in particular was raging, the Bible was clearly on the side of the slaveholders. Abolitionists, those who said slavery is wrong and evil, were doing so not on the biblical basis, but on the basis of our modern interpretation and application of the love principle to all people. So abolitionists were hard-pressed to justify their opposition to slavery from the Bible. Yet today, if we were to ask even Christians in the American South if slavery is okay, most of them would say no. What saddens me in this whole raucous debate in the churches is how sub-Christian most of it has been. We need to take a few steps back and reevaluate ourselves. Take that finger that's pointing against and towards homosexual Christians or homosexual non-Christians and stop condemning. And point the finger at ourselves and say, how have we acted? The truth is, we are not given unequivocal guidance in the area of homosexuality. And it is significant that Jesus never addresses the issue. And we would be very foolishly naive to suppose that there were not some homosexual followers in the ranks of those who listened to and were disciples of Jesus. Rather than tearing at each other's throats, because if you say, no, I do believe the Bible teaches against this and I'm sticking with it, then I am your neighbor. I can love you. I can be there for you. I can agree to disagree. I can't agree with you. I can't be your peaceful neighbor if you're going to attack and to condemn and to judge and to criticize others who are different from you or those who have a different view of the scriptures. How do I know that I am correctly interpreting scriptures then today in light of the love ethic? Well, I would simply say, how do you know that you're right? Have you ever been wrong before? Could you be wrong ever again? Wouldn't it be wiser to lower the decibels of the debate by 95% and recognize that we may never all agree on these points, that we may never prove to the conviction of anyone else how to apply the biblical principle of love. And we in the church need to get our priorities straight. We have not reached a consensus in the church in general about who is right on the issue of homosexuality. But what is clear, utterly clear, is that we are commanded to love one another. So if these are issues about which we cannot agree, then at the very least we should amiably agree to disagree. We don't have to tear whole denominations to shreds in order to air our differences on this or any other point.